I did part of my thesis on Gadamer, and Gadamer's quite clear about it. He says we've got Greek religion, which is really distinctive and separate from a lot of the stuff that we think we're talking about in Western religion, and then we've got the Athenian schools almost act as religions, and then you've got the influence from Eastern religions, and you've got so many things going on even inside the Western tradition that you find you're doing comparative religion, quote unquote, without realizing it necessarily. But comparative religion is kind of seems a bad word, no?
Yeah,
kind of is, isn't it? Whenever I teach Americans, I end up teaching comparative religion, and they're not scared of the word. Those words, they kind of go, "Oh yeah, comparative religion, great stuff. That's what we want to do." Indiana Jones,
Did Indiana Jones do comparative religion?
No, he did archaeology actually. But
exactly, he did archaeology.
Yeah, exactly.
But he reads Sanskrit. I remember that bit.
Was there a bit where Indiana Jones reads?
Some of those things where I thought, "Oh, maybe this lark isn't that stupid."
Oh my gosh, no, there's a whole talk I give where I explain that Indiana Jones is my motivating force as an academic. But it's funny because, got the hat, I've got the leather jacket. But at a popular culture level, I think it's quite interesting how if the Da Vinci Code is the new indie, please don't read that terrible, terrible book, but or do like I did, read it without actually paying for it in Blackwell's. But if the character in that is a new indie, he's supposed to be the professor of comparative symbology at Harvard. Of course there is no such thing, but if there was, wouldn't that be an exciting role to have? Terrible idea, because it's incredibly Victorian and outmoded comparative symbology, But at the same time, they've done is remind Americans that comparative religion, was kind of this exciting thing that everybody wanted to do. And I don't know if you know Joseph Campbell, who's kind of the Jungian, he's the modern interpreter of Jung. I think one of his books is on the reading list. He's popular because he did a TV series. I heard of him because my American side of my family said, "Watch this TV series." Thank you. Perhaps we can pass that down, actually, because I think we need one down there. He did a really popular TV series in the States where he just went through world mythologies and explained how they related to each other and how they could illuminate our own lives. All the stuff you're not supposed to do in comparative religion, of course, actually. But he did it and it was really popular. And that's still what people are very excited about in many circles. Even though in England, if you can't have comparative religion courses because it's just, partly it's orientalist to have a comparative religion course. Partly there still hasn't been any solution on methodology, I guess. Is that the impression you get? It's not. Well, perhaps it's a good thing. Although it's funny because we end up doing the study of religion, and often that will mean that we're not doing any inter-religious study, as it were. There's always the option now in a study of religion course, almost always, to just do each religion individually, right? And you won't necessarily bring them into contact with each other in any way. Except maybe at Cambridge where there is a explicitly comparative paper, but that doesn't... the self and salvation paper.
Yeah,
which has been there for years and was quite pioneering, where it's self and salvation in Indian and Western thought. And only someone like Julius Lipner, who's kind of bluff and looks vaguely Victorian anyway, but sort of full of character and conviction, only he could get away with it, I think, in some ways.
I think even then we still answer the question entirely separately.
Yeah.
And the same with the imagination thing.
Which it's been interesting because they've taken the approach where they take themes, so self and salvation, and they'll look at, moksha and... Julius, who self-designates as a Hindu Catholic. You say, "What? A Catholic Hindu?" And he goes, "No, a Hindu Catholic." Getting one's priorities straight. It's a bit like John Hick going, "Oh, I love all the religions, especially Christianity, but all the religions." And Keith Ward, who's wonderful and a great pioneering voice in the field, gave a talk to a big dinner full of almost all Hindus and started talking about how wonderful Hinduism was and how great it was and how it was nearly as great as Christianity and,
I remember people who started doing religious studies in Berlin they all came up saying like, oh, we want to learn something about ourselves, mm-hmm. you know, and they really want it. They go for the degree because mm-hmm. they're actually looking for a religion
yeah.
they want to pick, so they do end up comparing them,
yeah.
like, which one's more convincing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. And that's, you know, I think that's an interesting phenomenon. I actually think for a lot of people that is exactly why. Oh, yes. Yeah, there you go.
Thanks.
That's exactly why they end up studying religions. In many cases, they're looking for ideas. But of course, you're not meant to do that as a scholar, or at least you're not meant to let that come into your discourse in any way as a scholar. You're supposed to just go around and try and find out what they think. Although in many cases, it's raised the issue that as a scholar, you're not, in a way, allowed to say what your goals are. You know, there's this notion that you just have to find out what is the case just for the sake of filling in the box full of knowledge. And that box has a drawer that says, you know, Jainism, and a drawer that says Hasidism, and a drawer that says etc., etc. But to ask a larger question about why you're doing it is something people have to be sort of very careful about. You know, which is, again, maybe it's one of the themes of this little lecture series, that's on the one hand very important. We're all learning the habit of holding back judgments. We're all learning the habit. I think it's actually not a habit of a poche, of sort of pulling yourself back from material so that you don't cast a judgment on it and being objective. I actually think that what we're learning is a habit of kind of almost the opposite, getting so involved in each topic, getting so involved in each view, each world that each topic, each religion paints, that rather than being objective at a distance and unmoving, we're actually being incredibly flexible and moving from one world to another. And of course, you know, in some ways I'm not going to engage that much today with the insider-outsider debate, but one of the reasons for that is that I think it's to some extent a little bit outmoded. I think some of the books published even 5 years ago have to be seen in a different light, because what, you know, modernity has turned into is kind of mass immigration in all directions, where it isn't that hard to talk to the insider, you know, and you can no longer tell who's an insider and who's an outsider, because your kids, you know, you think that you can't understand the worldview of the Korean Buddhist who lives next door until your kid makes friends with them at the playground in the course of building a sandcastle, brings them home for dinner, and you know, you become one within the community. And actually you start to realize that the issues of interpretation are on a sliding scale with all the issues of interpretation and understanding that you have even within your own culture. So in a way, I think a lot of those boundaries have been relativized. And there was a big ethical drive behind affirming the insider-outsider problem. You know, we have to respect the other, we can't assimilate them to our own way of thinking. But actually now I think people realize there are ethical reasons not to cater to this idea that there are giant boundaries between all of us. You know, but that actually boundaries aren't that big. There have been Indian influences on Western thought for, you know, probably millennia, actually, and vice versa for millennia, actually. There have been trade routes crisscrossing from the Orient to Western Europe for millennia, and they have been carrying cultural influences. And that, at a deep, basic level, is relatively uncontroversial. You know, if you want to say that Jesus is the result of, you know, Buddhism that's been directly transmitted, well, obviously that gets a bit silly. But the idea that those boundaries are not so strong, and that there is change and there's mixture, and that people are not only talking to the other now, but marrying the other, having children who are both self and other. You know, people are increasingly bilingual. It's quite interesting, I think, that in the West we're terrified of the idea that we'll never understand another language. And often that's precisely the form that the methodological skepticism is given in critiques and commentaries. You know, however much we learn Mandarin, we'll never understand the full semantic range of some particular religious concept that we're given in it. But in a way, it sounds to me like it's reflecting the experience of a culture that tends not to learn much more than one language well, that tends not to be genuinely bilingual, for instance, where people grow up knowing more than one language, knowing more than one cultural world. The idea that that's kind of impossible, I think, should be taken away. And I'll look at some examples of anthropologists, in a way, who are kind of the proto-immigrants, who would go and be in another culture and have to try and live in that other culture. Some of them, you know, now undergrads will do, you know, 9 months in Tibet or whatever. But you read people who've done 17 years someplace, and they come back and they say, I am no longer just a Western self. You know, I'm a multiple self. And actually, we often are, and that's fine. And so translation shouldn't be such a major, major problem. So that's one of the things that I feel should change the way that we look at quote-unquote comparison. Let's not say comparative religion, because that sounds like a discipline. But let's note that we compare many different things. There are faculties of comparative literature, and how that is so different from comparative religion is not immediately clear. You know, we're going to compare, and that shouldn't in itself be a problem. So that's, I think that affects the way things have developed. I just realized I haven't got any of the notes myself, and is it possible that I can borrow just to look at the copy? Sorry about this. Is that okay? I forgot how many people we are. So I'm not going to deal with that in very great detail, but I just want to note that my own PhD, which thank goodness will be published next year, is a comparative study. And was it controversial doing a comparative study? In some ways, it still is. They say, what's your PhD on? And I say, well, I did Continental Thinker, and I compared his metaphysics, it's very philosophical, I compared his metaphysics to an Indian thinker. And, you know, a lot of people go, ooh, well, that's a bit crazy, isn't it? And off they go. And, of course, you know, there has to be a whole chapter at the beginning that explains the methodology. And from my perspective, just at the outset, I think half of that is about minimizing the differences. And we'll look at the way that some people do that. Half of that is about expanding the differences. Actually, there are so many differences within our culture that the differences between supposed cultures become much less striking. And then another part of that is also about saying, you know, given that, what are going to be the points of orientation? And in my own study, that was very much about partly borrowing from philosophy. I think there are more and less stable systems you can look at. It does sound very old-fashioned, but it is sort of true. 1 + 1 tends to be 2. That's not that. Not that it isn't culturally relative. It is culturally relative. All those terms are culturally relative. But at some level, 1 + 1 is more likely to be 2 than asking your wife to do the dishes every day is necessarily going to be universally agreed to be a bad thing. You know, some things are more and some things are less. Flexible, in a sense. So philosophy, you know, likes to suggest that it can use certain things, if it's genuinely focusing on philosophical issues, as kind of a framework, a scaffold on which to compare. And of course, given that we all know now that you don't try and assimilate everything, you focus on difference as much as sameness. And that's become a big leitmotif. You don't just say it's the same, you say it's different. And you get as excited about the difference as you do about the sameness. And actually, in some ways, what you were saying about people wanting to choose different religious views, in some ways, that it aids that whole goal. It used to be the case that it was all about the perennial philosophy. Everyone wanted to show that there's a single human nature or a single transcendent reality, either one, and that all the religions were going to help prove this. And that's the case in so, you know, most of the classical thinkers that we read, actually. Freud, to some extent Marx, Fraser, of course, Tyler in many respects, You know, John Hick and Rudolf Otto, they're all perennial philosophers. But in some ways, perhaps it's true that the goal is no longer to show that we're all the same so much as to get excited about the differences, because what we want is as Westerners, and of course this is reflecting a discourse as quote-unquote the Western academic scholar, what we tend to want as a discipline is actually freedom and options, rather than assimilative affirmation of the self. And of course that's variable as well, but if we once wanted to say, look, check this out, the other person's views in some sense confirm my identity, there's an argument that now we don't want our identity confirmed anymore. We want actually for it to be expanded with a wider range of options that are open to us. You know, which very much reflects, I think, a shift in what modernity means. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I remember an entertaining argument my mother had with an ex-chaplain of King's College, Cambridge, who said, she said, oh, I love all the religions. I think they're all great and they've all got some truth, you know. Very kind of post-hippie, you know, American thing to say. And the chaplain said, oh, yes, I quite agree. But, you know, of course, you can't just pick and choose, you know. And she sort of said, why not? Cue huge argument, you know. But it is an interesting argument. There still is an issue in there about whether you have to commit, whether truth systems have to be coherent, systematic, you know, and in some sense exclusive, or whether actually one can borrow along the way. Now, of course, all of that's within a particular question of indeed how we relate to the religions and whether they have truth in them. And that's a particular issue. We won't necessarily engage with that at all in the course of doing the study of religion. So I just want to note those questions. And one other caveat at the beginning, religious pluralism, quote unquote, of course, is now often taken to mean more or less one thing. John Hick, you know, his rainbow of faiths, the universe of faiths. So John Hick, if many of you will know his ideas, he wrote a number of books in which he, as a Christian theologian, who he talks about his own biography, had spent a lot of time in, say, Birmingham, in very multicultural environments, and taught and worked there, had really had as a practical issue to engage with the plurality of different cultures and faiths in the world. And he had, coming from very much, we can't really understand Hick without understanding some basic bit of Kant. From a Kantian background, he'd said, well, this is fine that there's diversity. We're all perceiving the same kind of noumenal transcendent object, right? We're all perceiving that object, but that's very much like in Rudolf Otto, who's also a Kantian. But that transcendent object is beyond our the interpretative matrix, the interpretative categories of our mind. And what happens is we perceive it and then our mind interprets it for us. How does it interpret it? According to the cultural and rational paradigms of our culture. So that accounts for all the differences. It accounts for, you know, the way that we'll interpret it as a personal God or an abstract God, a nice God or a nasty God, an authoritative God or a loving God, etc., etc., etc. But it allows for the idea that there's a single truth beyond that, to which they all refer. So it preserves cultural relativism and diversity, but at the same time it asserts truth, value to those truth claims. All of them. And it does this using this sort of Kantian background. And Hick's idea is very interesting. And of course, you know, so many people, when they first hear it, and continue to hear it, so many people say, yeah, that's great. And actually, that's what I believe. I think it's one of the great virtues of Hick's position was that he really voiced something that a lot of people felt from a long time, that, you know, lots of people were basically perceiving the same thing but interpreting it in different ways according to their background and inclinations. Fine. Although I also think it's true that in this book, just as an example, in this book, which I think is a good, very good book, A Magic Still Dwells, Comparative Religion in the Postmodern Age, one of the few books that are good books on the fate of comparative religion and the possibility of continuing to do it that have been done. A Magic Still Dwells by Kimberly Patton and Benjamin Ray. I'll leave it here. They cite one of the authors in it cites a nice instance where William Paden, or Padden, I don't know how you say his name, talks about all the religions as different matrixes of meaning, very similar kind of thing. He says that's fine, but a student jumps up and says, yes, but you're not addressing the truth claims of those religions. You've forgotten, by reducing them to meaning systems, you've forgotten to address their truth claims. And similarly, John Hick did a talk here where he explained this wonderful Kantian scheme of all the religions. He was introduced by Keith Ward, who in many ways follows us. He's much more careful about what he says, but he sort of follows a quiet, covert, I think similar perspective. Ultimately, he sees the religions as all perceptions and interpretations of the same basic divine truth and the same basic human experience. But the problem with Hick was at the end, other students and myself said, but you seem to think that you're assimilating all religious positions to one meta position, which will make them all happy. And of course, actually what you're doing is you putting forward a counter claim of your own. You too are a theologian. And if you say to, for instance, this Muslim or this Buddhist, you know, guys, it's okay, you're perceiving the same thing, but, you know, the idea that it was Muhammad who saw the archangel, or that it was Buddha who achieved a certain, you know, experience and of this particular kind, all of that's just about your particular cultural interpretation, you know, so don't stress. It just isn't going to work for most people. It would be very clearly and explicitly a rejection of their beliefs, and not just an assimilation of them to a higher way of looking at things. And actually, when that question was asked of John Hick, he said, yes, of course, I'm a theologian. You know, this is my position. I'm not actually trying to give an interpretative matrix that will objectively preserve and explain all the religions. You know, so it's important to see that he is a theologian. And it's funny how many essays you get where they'll discuss him and at the end they'll go, but you know, he seems a bit theological. I'm not sure about this. Of course, that's the case. And that's fine. It's a very interesting theory, you know, but he's certainly not doing something that every, or I think indeed most, religious people will go along with. So those are my caveats. Just to look at some of the issues that are raised, just to point out that comparative religion as such is seen, it's rejected in the form of a kind of a Victorian to, from you know, from the Victorian era to sort of the 60s and 70s, and at the early end you've got J.G. Fraser, you know, rushing in his armchair, rushing mentally through the world's religions, taking what he needs of them, interpreting them according to a particular preset model, which is the priesthood at Nemi, and you know, using them in a way to discuss his own issues. If you haven't had a look at the Golden Bough, it's fantastic fun, and do have a look at it. But you know, that bad model is at the beginning of what we see as comparative religion, because he mostly gets it wrong, and he's actually not that concerned to get it right, which I think, you know, can be seen to have its own agenda and values, you know, if you put it within that context. But you see him at the beginning, and then you see perhaps at the end someone like Joseph Campbell, who is this Jungian thinker that I spoke of, who again explicitly says, here's a lot of religions, particularly interested in mythology, here are many myths, here's what they tell us about us in our lives. And arguably, I think, you can see people, more modern people like Wendy Doniger, who writes about myth, as doing something much more methodologically cautious, but similar in some ways in its goals. And Wendy Doniger's written some really, really interesting books where she'll go through a theme within a range of myths. So she's done one on, trying to remember, the implied spider, I think it's on religious authority.
Shiva, the erotica sedic.
Yeah, exactly. She's done ones about asceticism. She's done ones about sex and violence. She's actually gotten in trouble because she has been rather orientalist in her approach. She has actually tended to focus on lurid, exciting, and quote-unquote exotic bits of other myths. One of the reasons she's done that is because she's also very Freudian. She kind of wants to look underneath what they're saying and say, look, they're voicing the hidden instincts that we cannot even speak of in the repressed culture of the West. You know, she's doing it for a reason, but she's very much focusing on particular issues. And the way that she focuses primarily on those issues in quote-unquote other cultures makes it seem as if the other cultures only focus on sex and violence, and actually ours is all about, you know, civilization and sensibleness. So there has been an issue, I think, with her. But, you know, having said that, she, like others, has noted useful things, many great insights along the way. All of these people, you take them with the right pinch of salt, and then you get a lot out of them. But between those two thinkers, you know, within that range, actually, outside of that, comparative religion has a long, long history and is a much older subject than people tend to realize. Now, in many ways, if you do a history of comparative religion, you start with Herodotus. You know, you start with Thucydides. You start to say that comparative religion is all about every context in which people meet other cultures have to understand and interpret them. And from that perspective, it's a very different business. You can read that, you know, travelers like Ibn Battuta, who's the Muslim cleric on whom Sinbad was based, who traveled and kept diaries of his travels. You know, it's interesting to read these people and what they make of other cultures. Giambattista Vico is an interesting Renaissance French example. Hegel, of course, is effectively doing comparative religion. Not necessarily doing it well, but his goals, some of his ideas are quite right. Very expansive study, and really wants to look at the whole of human output. In some ways, he's much better. He's not just looking at five world religions and then, you know, throwing the rest out the door. So the history is much wider. Why? It does raise the issue, especially now when everyone has the option to just focus on particular religions individually. Why would you want to speak of more than one religion at all? Classically, there's often an agenda to that. One, you know, the most modest, is just to increase the knowledge of the religions as part of a larger project of increasing the knowledge of what humans do. You know, in theory, you can have just a knowledge acquisition goal. And also to make them comprehensible, each to the other. Perhaps, of course, that has another goal in facilitating a happy, comfortable, effective community. But you can try and leave it at that. Of course, many of the classic, quote-unquote, comparative religionists, especially within that phase that we talked about, it's about bringing them within a single scheme of interpretation and understanding. It's about talking about their genesis, Tyler or Fraser or Freud, or their significance, or their function, say Berger, Durkheim, or some other key which is supposed to answer all of them at once. It's an interesting desire in the first place to be able to find the one thing that gives you a way into everything else. And in a way, I think that reduces to the next goal. It's about proving something about humanity or culture or the world as a whole. So often, if you're looking at a multiple range of them, it'll be trying to say something about something more essential and something more universal. And of course, in many cases, this will all be about influencing a concrete situation, actually changing the society in which this happens. This means that pluralism involves at least two levels. On the one hand, there's what's been called the hermeneutic problem, the problem of facing the difficulty of actually making sense of many, many bits of information and trying to interpret many, many bits of information. In fact, there are two levels within that problem. One is just to get the information in the first place, which is not an easy thing. You know, even today, we collect scriptures and then we realize that only represents a few people. We send out anthropologists into the field, but again, that's really chiseling away at a huge block, and even they will only get so deep into the culture. You know, we're always trying to figure out how to find out more about the religions, just to gather the information and get into the difficult spaces in a way. that desire to actually get the information is very much both about expanding the remit of the knowledge, you know, which cultures or tribes haven't we looked at, but also about deepening the knowledge. Let's not just look at the texts, let's not just look at the rituals, let's not just look at the patriarchal authorities, let's actually get deeper in there. So that's one part of that problem. The second part of it is, once you've got the information, how do you interpret it? That's the hermeneutic problem. You know, and yes, that is where the insider-outsider debate comes in, the problems of understanding the other culture, and at the same time, that's where we have to ask what understanding is in the first place. More and more people do look to thinkers like Gadamer and Ricoeur to try and open up that possibility. What's that?
There's a cat. There's a cat. Someone's looking for.
I'm just going to close the window because there's actually a note downstairs that says someone's looking for a black cat.
Oh my goodness. Let's see if the cat.
She's not looking for the black cat. In fact, I think Dominic mentioned it to be told to somebody on the ground floor about the cat. Once you see it, I can check.
Excellent. We've caught the cat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm a bit worried about time, but okay.
Well, carry on.
Okay. Okay, let's keep going. Lecture interrupted by cat. So, just broadly on that, you've got the problem of gathering the knowledge, the problem of interpreting the knowledge. But you also have this idea that pluralism at a totally different level has an ethical dimension, where when you say pluralism, people go, oh yeah, we're in a plural society, we have to help facilitate this plural society. Suddenly the, not comparative religionist, but suddenly the student of religions, we used to be all about finding the hidden truth of life. Wonderful quotes from Jung, there's fantastic ones in here that are very, sound very modern in certain ways. Great quotes from thinkers like Thomas Mann and Hermann Hesse, who have similar things to say, and I put some of those down. Let's see if I can find the one I'm looking for here. Yeah, Joseph Campbell kind of exemplifies this when he says, once this subject catches you, there's... Oh, well, hold on, no, that's a different point. Oh, no. That's about
talking of Gadamer and Ricoeur.
Yeah, that's, well, hold on. The quote that I've got down here is about the joy of comparative religion. I mean, there's a big issue now that it used to be about making you happy and excited, and now what the comparative religionist does is help to facilitate, cool London. You know, this idea of the cool multicultural urban society in which we now live, and suddenly we have a totally different identity and value, as it were. Which is not necessarily a bad thing, although one wants to be able to pick and choose one's own goals and identity, ultimately. So these different parts have to be dealt with, and often the two get in the way. It's interesting to note that comparative religion's often been done within particular groups. It's like every other discipline, it's very much about particular affiliations. It's interesting, for instance, to note the Eranos group. You may know that Jung, Eliade, Joseph Campbell, lots of other characters who came in and out of that group, Gershom Scholem, Henri Corbin, they were all part of a group called the Eranos group that still meets every year, which explicitly brought together people to do comparative religion to try and discover truths about human life. And that's still the case, that you'll get groups coming together with particular agendas. So, okay, what are some of the ways in which we've had to deal with all these different things? What are some of the issues that arise? I've looked at just briefly the problem of comparative religion as kind of a problem of broad knowledge. How do you get that range of knowledge in any case? It's not an easy thing to do. And very much there's been a process in, quote-unquote, the study of religions and the study of comparative religion to collate different aspects of the culture. More and more people now will focus on cultural artifacts, objects, maybe archaeology or other, you know, material culture studies, maybe practices, maybe arts, maybe texts. And you'll put all of these different aspects together to try and draw that picture. And often that's what you do when you do a study. you're putting a layer onto that matrix, so in the end we'll get a really good map. It's like Google Maps when you get all the different levels sort of appearing on a single image. Also, that comes out in terms of groups within the culture. So let's say you'll have people now looking not only at the output of the literate classes in North India, but you'll also look at South India, you'll look at the tribes, you'll also look at what's happening towards Pakistan, you'll look at what's happening maybe in Bangladesh, you'll look at transmission to Sri Lanka, and you'll try and bring out what might be called marginal groups. You'll look at, say, women. You'll look at not only the priests, but also the craftsmen who built the temples. You'll try and fill in that picture in terms of the actual population. often now you'll do a study not only of the major cultures, what you call the grand tradition, but the subcultures, the little traditions. I was looking at Mircea Eliade's History of Religious Ideas. And it's interesting because as he goes through these histories, volume 3 is really interesting. Judaism, what does he look at? Hasidic and Kabbalistic sects. Protestantism, what does he look at? He starts off by talking about witchcraft and magic. What are other ones? Islam, what does he look at? He talks about the Ismaili sect, and Shiism, which isn't really the norm, I think. And you'll find this kind of pattern being repeated. Eastern Orthodoxy, he ends up looking at shaman in Eastern Europe. So he's trying to pull out the subcultures, the hidden voices. And I think it's actually quite an interesting, useful thing to do. You can imagine taking a standard world religions reader and then, augmenting it actually with Eliade's book and getting a sense of the main culture and the subculture, which is often, in terms of population numbers, just as important. Sometimes more important, because it's the religion of the masses rather than the literate classes. So that's been quite an interesting, useful thing to do. And also, I think, with Geertz particularly, you get a sense that we have to take account not only of that which lasts. More and more, people will say, oh, here's a movement that developed, but it didn't last, so we won't talk about it. We'll start to look at that which comes and goes as equally important. And in some ways, Geertz set the tone for this. His classic book, Islam Observed, which has been widely criticized for being very subjective, very literary. But of course, at the last page, he says, hey guys, I know it's subjective. I know it's literary. I know that it's very much a creating of a narrative from these stories. It's a book in which he contrasts Indonesian Islam with Moroccan Islam, very, very beautifully written in many ways. And he has a whole beginning section on just the theory of the nature of religion. But he very much says, let's look at transition and change. And one of the things he's doing, of course, is that classic thing that Fraser does, is trying to reflect upon his own society as a society in which religion is in a state of transition and change. And should we be upset by that? Should we only consider the major tradition that we came from and that concrete, solid, coherent, wide-scale tradition that we're trying to turn into? Or actually, is transition, moment-by-moment, change, our short movements, just as valid, interesting, and revealing in themselves? So you also get a shift to look chronologically a little bit deeper into the matrix, as it were. So that's made a difference along the way. Now, of course, we still have comparative religion as a universalist enterprise, although people like Gellner have very much suggested that we look at particularism rather than universalism. Very fits very well, actually, with Geertz's study, the idea that instead of looking at Middle Eastern Islam as the universal paradigm for all Muslims, suddenly you look at maybe Chinese Islam and North African Islam, Spanish Islam and Indian Islam, and look at those particularities as much more interesting and exciting and actually perhaps more apt to tell you what is uniting about, what is coherently true about Islam than just looking at what's seen as a kind of a paradigmatic case will be. And often it's more fun. You get to travel to more places. So that has affected universalism. It's still the case, I think, that it has these old tendencies within it. But I think people are more careful. I think people have to be more careful. It's interesting to see that Geertz may be one of the most recent people, and that's quite a long time ago now. Not many people do comparative religion. You know, Geertz still has an idea of what is common in religion at the heart of his study. What is common in religion is people creating symbolic systems that reflect their lives, and as their lives change, altering the symbolic systems. Right. And of course, he talks about concretion. Sometimes the symbolic system gets so strong, you can't change it very easily. And then you have to wait for it to kind of crack open of its own accord. That religious crisis happens when you haven't got the power to change the religion to reflect your own life. So in a way, the tension builds up until the religion itself cracks open. Some people will say these things like this are happening in Christianity. But that's okay, then it cracks open, and then you go through turmoil, and then eventually new symbols spring up in the gap and are adopted because they do indeed reflect the vivifying life.
Mm-hmm. But Geertz doesn't have a proper explanation for where the symbols come from. Because he can't really explain the sort of nature, culture transition, right?
I think, well, he says that, in fact, where's that? I got the quote in here. He talks about the paradox of religions that don't reflect people's lives, and this quote on the second page: on the secular level, the resolution of this paradox lies in the fact that religion is not the divine, nor even some manifestation of it in the world, but a conception of it. Now, he actually elsewhere says, I don't want to talk about, he says, whatever the really real may be like, men make do with images of it, that they take, if they are faithful, as both images of it and guides for relating themselves to it. And which images, if any, seem revelatory and directive in this way, is a function of place, as I tried to show in the last chapter, and of time, as I shall show in this, he writes in Islam Observed. I mean, one of the things he says, I don't want to deal with whether this is experience are really real. He doesn't enter into that Hickean debate. And actually, there's a big debate with Eliade that says, does he think there's a really real that the sacred corresponds to? And I think you can read Eliade either way. People criticize him for being a theologian, and I think actually you can resist that and do either version. But with Geertz, he says, I don't want to deal with that. But it's true that humans create the symbols to reflect their experience, whatever that experience may turn out to be. The symbols have to stay true to the experience. You know, and he doesn't answer the issue of whether the experience reflects only natural or also supernatural, if you see what I mean. So I think he kind of resists having to deal with that.
Not supernatural, but sort of cultural.
Yeah. In the sense that, I mean, he says the input from the symbols can come from nature, just, you know, as it were, raw experiences of the world, or raw experiences of culture, so you get that kind of looping feedback. As it were, the symbols create new symbols. And indeed, it might come from supernature, it might come from God. You know, all of those experiences are going to go to create this cultural web. I shouldn't say web, that sounds very Weberian. He is a Weberian in a sense. He doesn't say where it comes from, but in a sense he does. He says this is the mind making sense of the world. And he's very much like Vico in that respect. People had been saying, people like Fraser would always say that to make sense of the world is a rationalistic pursuit. You're just trying to make sense of it. Sense seen in a scientific sense. Whereas actually Vico had long ago said that sense for humans is poetic, not scientific. For something to have sense, to have meaning is a poetic engagement. And in a way, Geertz, I think, reflects this sort of idea. You make a symbol system, you're almost making art, you're making a constellation of meanings, and then you work from there. They will become systematic and reflect a conception of reality, and that reality always has to engage with your actual experiences on an everyday level. You know, so it's this kind of loop that feeds around and around. So it's one of the things that Geertz Geertz offers that model. Is there a universalistic assumption within it? Yeah, I think he does have to end up saying something about human nature in order to account for exactly how the symbols arise. You know, and in some ways, maybe it suggests that you couldn't... How can you talk about religion and the generation of meaning? In fact, how can you talk about what the symbols mean without having to deal with some discussion of how humans think, interact, relate, etc.? And Geertz actually has kind of an entertaining quote where he cites, I think it's Evans Pritchard, you know, the most straightforward and direct perception will confirm for us that, in fact, you know, we must understand human rationality in order to understand the constructs of human reason. And Geertz says, yes, he's quite right. The most brief and cursory glance will indeed confirm that. In fact, so brief and cursory a glance that we start to ask why anyone would even ask. You know, isn't it obvious that we would have to deal with what human thought is, and in some sense, therefore, human nature, in order to be able to talk about what comes out of it? So in some ways, there's a suggestion that maybe you're collapsing this whole criticism of comparative religionists as people who want to ask deep questions about humans.
What's wrong with supposing that there is a human nature?
Yeah, well, no, exactly. But this is a kind of essentialist issue. You know, are you making an assumption? Are you forcing an interpretation of humans onto people in order for them to be able to use your comparative religious insights? And that's seen as problematic. You know, but it may be that that's an intrinsic part of the methodology, that you can't make any discoveries without doing that to some extent. And that's probably true. If it's true in religion, it's probably true throughout the human sciences and any human act of understanding, which is actually what the hermeneutics thinkers end up saying effectively. So in some ways, the criticisms need to be taken, dealt with, you know, and handed back. So anyway, the universalism issue therefore goes down to deeper hermeneutic issues now. I've just briefly mentioned the idea of comparative religion as the religious marketplace. There's the Joseph Campbell quote. Once this subject catches you, there's such a feeling from one or another of these traditions of information of a deep, rich, life-vivifying sort that you don't want to give it up. You know, he puts this in, you know, one of his classic books. And you can see that he's talking to a popular audience. And you can see that he's meant to get you excited, you know. One of these traditions, whichever one it happens to be, it doesn't matter, will vivify your life. You know, and that will be in many respects rejected now, but I think actually it is true in that that's what often happens to people. And it's one of the reasons that people do religious studies degrees in many cases. Many young people now will do it because they don't know what they believe and they actually want to find out what the different things people believe are. And somewhere in that is not idle curiosity, but genuine human interest, you know, that it may be illuminating in some way. Again, that can be seen to collapse into hermeneutic issues about why we gather information in the first place. You know, is there ever such a thing as purely idle curiosity? You know, but in each of these cases, while we affirm the personal motives, we have to also affirm a deep caution methodologically, where we don't just take the bit that we like and fly with it. Or if we do, we acknowledge that that's kind of like literature. And many thinkers now, some of the thinkers in this volume, will say, actually, that's fine. What we do when we do comparative religion now is, in some sense, an imaginative, creative engagement. That has to be accurate. Doesn't mean they get to just be inaccurate. But it will always be selective in respect of particular issues that indeed are what you're looking at in the first place. If you're looking at purity in Judaism and in Hinduism, you know, why are you looking at that issue? What are you hoping it's going to tell you? Whatever conclusions you come to will be illuminating in one way or another. You know, and how silly to say that it mustn't be illuminating in any way, and that we shouldn't admit that, if you see what I mean. You know, strange thing going on there. Levi-Strauss mentions this notion of bricolage. He says when people create myths in ancient cultures, they take bits of what they get from the world around them and cobble them together, a sort of a collage. And he says in some ways that can be seen as one of the things that we do in the modern world. And anthropologists often report learning from other cultures in this way. There's a wonderful quote from Marcel Mauss in some wonderful quotes in this, Fiona Bowie's Anthropology of Religion. It's a wonderful quote where he talks about squatting. He goes to other cultures. I had this in India. He goes to other cultures, you know, and you're standing around for 2 hours, 3 hours while the bus is being fixed, and you'll kind of get tired, and you haven't got anywhere to stand, or the train station, and whatever. And everyone else is just sort of squatting, just to have this wonderful ability to sit there and, you know, kind of balanced on the 2 feet, you know, and really comfy, eating, everything's fine. And he notices that he can't do that, and in fact most of his Western friends can't do that. And he says, it's really a pain, because you get really tired, but everyone else is cool. So, you know, the anthropologist does this at a cultural level anyway. You know, and between the cultural bricolage and the religious bricolage, maybe it's not such a big gap.
who's that by?
That was Marcel Mauss. Oh, the book is Fiona Bowie, The Anthropology of Religion. It's really great. It's a wonderful, good survey of anthropologists. Really, and she also has a lot of philosophy. A lot of the first chapter just looks at all the classic thinkers. so I'm going to skip over comparative religion as relativism. This is a big issue, and I just look briefly at how even, you know, Eliade, so many people end up saying that the religious forms are just culturally relative. And that's fine, but as we've said with the universalism issue, they tend to posit something central underneath. The main thing I want to say, I think, towards the end, sorry, is that comparativism has, in its ethical, social context, come to be seen as a framework in which different religions have to come together. And they've been seen as incommensurable. The boundaries are drawn with thick lines between them, and our difficult goal is to cross that line. And as I kind of suggested, more and more, that complexity, even within a single culture, makes that notion of boundaries less and less, you know, clear. Quickly, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I read in an anthropologist study, there was like this mention of the fact that the other,
yeah,
they can read our stuff as well. They,
yeah,
do the same things,
yeah,
that we do. They study us as well.
Yeah.
And there is this sort of worldwide academic language that everyone understands.
Yeah.
I mean, it's English, you know. We can understand each other. It's not like,
yeah, there's so,
oh,
much.
They're so alien, you know. Let's not talk to them, because we won't understand them anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a real problem with, quote unquote, sorry, it's really rough, with othering the other. You know, every time I go to Cordoba or I go to Granada, and I, you know, think of Maimonides and Aquinas and all these people circulating around together and how well they got on, you know, and then you look at modern situation in, say, Israel and Palestine, and you think how much modern circumstances of conflict have governed our notion of the other, whereas actually you can read an intensely multicultural history of almost every culture that you're looking at as own or other. So that helps. And I've given a quote here from Geertz where he talks about the idea that religion's changing, religion being multiple, is quite a positive thing. One of the big, I guess my theme for that, for our last 2 minutes, is partly that a lot of the idea of the incommensurability of religions depends on a spatial metaphor that's been picked up by many people. Jonathan Z. Smith talks about it. It's part of the critique of Mircea Eliade, a notion that we have, each religion covers a different bit of territory on the map, very geopolitical model. And you step over the boundary into someone else's world, and everything within that space is theirs, is other, follows their own hermeneutic matrix, right? And then you can step back over, you know, once you get off of Eurostar or whatever. And that actually this is highly, highly flawed way of looking at things. You know, and Israel is an excellent example. There have always been so many multiple religious and ethnic groups in the Middle East, you know, and yet how mad that we end up seeing it as a particular person's possessed territory in any of those directions towards any of those people. Sam Gill makes an interesting comment in that Critical Terms in Religious Studies book. He has a chapter on territory where he says in Australian cultures, you are attached to the land, you have territory, but it's not to a bounded space. Your attachment to the land is more like a trail of points. It reflects a journey. So the points along that way, think of it in terms of a pilgrimage, you know, are actually your spaces, but not a big space into which other people can't come. So what you have is that you possess a trajectory, and others have a trajectory, and you will cross at certain points, and those meeting points actually become shared spaces. But it's, if you look at it in terms of a line rather than, you know, as it were, a geometric shape, then suddenly you don't possess territory in the same way. You intersect and interact. It's interesting to look at the ancient history, say, of Mecca, the idea that it only becomes the center of Islam precisely because, as a shrine for many different religious groups, it was a meeting point of different tribes, of different religions, Christians, Jews, Magians or Astrians, different people would come to this center and meet there. And that made it a positive, expansive, quite cosmopolitan space that in fact cultivated someone like the Prophet actually living there. You know, and in some ways that's what Medina was as well. He was there not taking that space initially, but actually sharing it as an interactive conversational community with others. And that's how it was even possible for it to happen. So, you know, people criticize Eliade for having instituted this notion of possessing sacred space. You know, and if you read the sacred and the profane, he really talks about, as it were, stepping over the door of the church into that sacred space that belongs to the sacred. And he's been sharply criticized for that. But just as a last point, I think it doesn't have to be seen that way. I've put in a quote from Eliade here that I encourage you to look at. But for him, the thing is actually that the space mustn't be neutral. In a sense, he wants to say that secular space, which is supposed to be seen as a neutral platform, he says is just as problematic. In some cases, that's exactly where religious conflict happens. Whereas when everyone's in a sacred space, then actually maybe ethics and interactionality come into play in a much more sharp and intense way. Does the sacred space have to belong to somebody is the big question. And you can argue with Eliade, I'll stop now, but you can argue with Eliade, no. If you complement the sacred and the profane with his book, The Myth of the Eternal Return, he says the sacred is sacred because something happens there, not because someone has written their name across that territory, but because that's where the sacred, quote-unquote, experience happens. And many people can be present at that happening together. A happening isn't something that people possess. It's something that everybody experiences together. And no one can actually, you can all talk about it, but no one can say, you know, objectively, that's what it was mine. Because everybody in some sense shared it. And so you could see his notion of sacred territory as perhaps a platform for people to interact rather than a kind of mutually exclusive territorial conflict in some deep way. And I think that fits with people like D.Z. Phillips, who speaks about us as living in different worlds. Georges Santayana, who has a great quote where he talks about a religion as another world into which you step. Evans Pritchard, who talks about how in his own culture, he says, I rejected and reject Zandane notions of witchcraft, but in their culture, in the set of ideas I then lived in, I accepted them. In a kind of way, I believed in them. And that's repeated in Bowie's book. I think Michael Kearney talks about the idea that when he lived in a witchcraft culture, he believed it. He was terrified. And he said when he came back, it wasn't that he stepped back over the boundary. He had become a new person who believed neither one nor the other, but something that learned from both. So it's going to be creative. And it doesn't always have to be about a mutual conflict of territorial claims or truth claims. You know, the linguistic paradigm that you can't speak two languages at once, you'll never understand both religious languages, I think it is gainsaid by a lot of experiences now we have of travel. There's a deep potential in the metaphor of travel for comparative religion, immigration and experience of the other. Okay, I'll leave it at that. 2 minutes over.